I'd like to introduce my good friend, Jiryu, who's come down from Green Dragon Temple, Green Gulf Farm, up in Marin, to be with us tonight. We practiced many years at Green Gulch and Tassajara. Jiryu spent his time in Japan, practicing over there as well. And it's always a treat to have you come. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I always enjoy coming here. It's such a beautiful zendo and a warm, wonderful sangha. So thank you for the invitation. And Shuso, thank you for hosting me. It's very, very pleasant to sit zazen with you all. As usual, wondering what it is that we're doing, why we come to this room, what we do when we get here, what we think it's doing for us, what we think it's doing for others. And in sitting a long period, you know, we sit for 40 minutes and sometimes have this feeling of in Zazen, it's kind of 40 minutes kind of spiraling down towards some depth. You know, you maybe start at some kind of surface mind and gradually over 40 minutes descend into kind of deeper and deeper Zazen. That's one view, that's one idea, one possibility of what Zazen can be. And then there's this other image of Zazen as kind of not really progressing at all, but just kind of, oh, hi, it's me, here I am. Oh, me again, here I am. So this kind of moments, you know, we're sitting in our mind and in our body, and then there are moments of kind of brightness that come through, moments of returning. And I guess I appreciate those different views, those different versions of what Zazen might be. Both the kind of settling and relaxing and deepening into some kind of concentrated state. See the value in that. And I also see the wonderful opportunity of Zazen as kind of not building towards anything. It's not like the 38th minute of Zazen is deeper than the first minute of Zazen. It's like, hey, here I am. Weird. Hey, here I am again. This keeps happening. The kind of moments of awakening, moments of attention. So I've been thinking a lot about our 40-minute periods of Zazen, and part of my current wondering about 40-minute sitting periods, which I love to do, I very much love to do a 40-minute period of Zazen. But recently I spent the fall at Tassajara Zen Mountain Center. It's kind of monastic mountain retreat, part of the San Francisco Zen Center group of temples. And it's where people go to sit a lot of 40-minute periods of Zazen. So, you know, you sit 40-minute period Zazen, the first minute of the first period, you know, you're up here, and then maybe by the by the end of the last period, you've spiraled down to some concentrated state. Anyway, people enjoy sitting a lot of 40-minute periods, and they go to Tassajara, where they get to do a lot of that. And I've lived at Tassajara and enjoyed many a 40-minute period. But this fall, I was down there with my 1.5-year-old son while my wife was doing all of the 40-minute periods of Zazen she could possibly stomach, which was a lot of them. She served as Shuso, so her job was to be at everything. And we had the warm invitation to come down as a family, and my job was to be at everything that my baby wanted me to be at, which didn't he didn't invite me to many 40-minute periods of zazen. He said, "Hey, Papa, why don't you go do a 40-minute period of zazen?" That didn't occur to him. So I thought, well, I love this practice. I love to do meditation. And in a way, I was thinking, I used to live at a place, for a short time, I lived at a place with a lot of horses. And I liked horseback riding. I thought, how wonderful to live in a place with horses. I get to do horseback riding. And I really love to do that. And I was into that for a couple of years. And then I left that place. And I went to a place where there weren't any horses. And I thought, well, I can't do horseback riding anymore. There's no horses. So I felt a little bit of that at Tassajara. You know, I didn't have a seat in the meditation hall. And I thought, well, I'd love to do 40-minute periods as often, but there's no horses. You know, there aren't the conditions in my life to support doing this meditation practice that I love. So I guess that means I can't do it. So if meditation is something like horseback riding that requires a horse, that requires some kind of condition, then I was finding myself in a situation where I didn't have the condition. So it seemed like, well, I guess I'll have to wait it out until the conditions arise. But that wasn't a sustainable solution for me. I'm too identified, I guess, with Zen practice to let it go, even for a 3-month period. So I thought, well, what if rather than see this meditation practice, rather than seeing it as a kind of spiraling down that takes a 40-minute duration to really achieve, what if I take on this idea of Zazen as a moment of waking up to myself, a moment of saying, hey, Kiryu, hey. A moment of letting go, a moment of dropping body and mind even, a moment of mindfulness maybe. Moment of opening to big mind, leaving aside small mind. A wide awareness, you know, from kind of constriction, but just a moment of widening awareness. And I thought, well, this kind of micro zazen, a kind of moment zazen, is really at the core. It's really what Zen is about, and this is available to me, even if I don't happen to have the horse, the condition of a 40-minute period of zazen. So rather than let those conditions block me, or rather than feel blocked from my practice, like, well, I guess I can't practice this fall, to really take the opportunity of this kind of momentary practice. And, you know, the Zen school is pretty clear that one moment of zazen, this one moment of turning, is complete meditation practice. So we do long retreats, but the tradition is clear that it's actually a moment. There's a moment of awareness, and that fulfills our meditation practice. There's nothing more to this than a moment of attention. That moment of attention can happen maybe once or twice in a 40-minute period, or it can happen walking down the street. God forbid it happen while giving a Dharma talk. It can happen wherever, or listening to a Dharma talk. If we don't protect ourselves against it, it's available at any moment. And it is the fulfillment of Zen. So the Platform Sutra, a basic Zen foundational text, says, one flash of wisdom, and in this text, wisdom and meditation are identical. One flash of wisdom, one flash of meditation, destroys 10,000 years of ignorance. It also says, if you do not practice wisdom, you are an ordinary person. If you practice for one instant of thought, your Dharma body will be the same as the Buddha's. So the Buddha did a lot of 40-minute periods, but he didn't become the Buddha because of all of the 40-minute periods in this model. He came because of a moment. When there was a moment, then he was a Buddha. And that's true for us too. When there's a moment of attention, then right there our practice is fulfilled. And then it slips away, and then it's back. There's not more of a Buddha in 40 minutes than there is in one moment. So we call this the sudden school. Zen is the sudden school because it doesn't take time; it's immediate. Another expression of this in the Zen tradition is from Bankei, a 17th century Zen master that I've been enjoying lately. He says, when the eye that sees into people is manifested, whenever it happens to be, that moment is the complete realization of the Dharma. I want you to know this. Whoever you may be, at that moment, you are my heir. So we think being the heir of a Dharma master, it takes a long time. A lot of fabric is involved and a lot of time is involved. We have to groom the horses, you know, bring them oats. But it's actually just a moment. Whoever you are, in a moment, you can wake up to your own life and fulfill the path. I also ran across long ago, and it always stuck with me, a teaching from Asanga, talking about Bodhisattva ethics, and he says that basically to maintain the status of a Bodhisattva, to keep your Bodhisattva credentials, to keep your credentials as a authentic practitioner of the way, every day you should do something, be it great or small, some worship, be it a single prostration, a four-line verse on the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha, or a single act of faith of remembering the Buddha. And as someone who believed that Zen really was about it, that practice was hard work and long work, it struck me that one moment of recollecting the Buddha was sufficient to maintain my Bodhisattva card. It doesn't say you need to do a 40-minute period every day. But it says don't neglect these little turnings. Don't neglect these little opportunities to practice meditation. And in a way, Zen monastic life, even though there are many extended periods of meditation in traditional Zen monastic life, really you could say the main thing that's happening in a Zen monastery or in a Zen training situation is little reminders, little pointers. You hear the bell, you pass another monk. These little pointers or little interruptions in the monastic that are built into the monastic day that keep you coming back, that keep you present. I was surprised when I was in Japan, I was surprised how little Zazen actually was practiced in a Japanese monastery. It seems like, well, Zen is 40-minute periods, and I hear that in Japan they practice really hard, so they probably do a lot of 40-minute periods. But they don't, you know, they do one in the morning, one in the evening. But then all day, they're getting these pointers to come back, you know, stand like this, put your shoes there. This kind of detail that invites you or that even requires you to have some attention, to come back to yourself. clarify the self that you come back to. It's hard to talk about what we do in Zazen. I feel like that's self as my, or this experience of being alive. Usually we call me, we call myself, and we experience ourselves either close to that or far away from that. It's not so much that I'm recommending a particular way of meditation, like come back to yourself or be mindful or be aware. But whatever you practice, whatever we practice in meditation, so we sit down and it's wonderful because we make an intention when we sit down in a room like this. But whatever that intention is, or however we conduct ourselves, whatever our practice is in a 40-minute period, I've been wondering whether, to what extent, I can do that same practice just in a moment that's unhindered by 39 other minutes, or the idea of 39 other minutes. So however you see it, whatever your practice is of meditation, do you think that it's more available in this room than outside of this room, or more available in the middle of a 40-minute period than not? And part of my own study has been seeing that I kind of think it is. Kind of think it's easier to get at in this longer period. So I'm encouraging myself, and maybe someone else, to let go of that kind of thinking. So then the question, or one of the questions that comes up, is how do we remind ourselves to do that? How do we take the opportunity that each moment has? So each moment is a complete opportunity for practice, for meditation, for wisdom. And the question is, will we take that opportunity or not? And it's true whether we're sitting or whether we're doing anything else. One of the practices that we sometimes hear about and sometimes practice at San Francisco Zen Center and other places is the mindfulness bell. I know some of you are familiar with this practice. Thich Nhat Hanh advocates this with the understanding that it's just a moment of meditation practice, wherever you are, has a kind of transformative power that extends into your day. So they, if you go to one of his temples, when the bell rings, everybody stops. So the bell rings and you stop, and you come back to yourself. You come back to your breath, you come back to your body. It's the strangest thing if you're not used to it. You're talking to somebody and the bell rings and then they just stop. And we do this at Zen Center in the kitchen. So we'll be working in the kitchen, chop, 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 and then someone will ring a bell. What a wonderful invitation to, it's as though, you know, what if you were in the 21st minute of Zazen? You know, ding, can you find that same mind right now? What's obstructing you right now from finding the mind that's at the bottom of your Zazen? Dropping off body and mind, opening wide attention, forgetting yourself, opening to big mind. And I've always loved this practice and celebrated it. But I have a friend who I was practicing with at Tassajara. Was a very strict Zen person. And she despised the mindfulness bell. She objected on, you could say, Buddha logical grounds to the mindfulness bell. Why should we stop to do our practice? So if our practice is being alive or meeting our life or opening our awareness, why are we encouraging each other that we should stop what we're doing in order to come back to some other thing that's our practice? Zen practice is often talked about as becoming one with our activity, or being aware of our life as it's unfolding. So why would we stop our activity so that we could be present? If we accept that we have to stop what we're doing in order to be present, then we're going to be in a situation of needing to balance presence and activity, balance presence and my real life. Not sure if that's clear. I think we could talk about balance as though there's two things. There's kind of my ordinary life, and then there's my practice, and I have to balance them. And how great, that was a mindfulness bell, so now I can have a moment of practice, so my day is a little more balanced. Or great, it's time for Zazen at the Zen Center, so now I can have a little more balance, because I've had a busy day and now I can have a moment of stopping, and that's wonderful. But also, behind that, implicit in that, is a kind of separation, is a kind of division. There's my life over here, and then there's awareness, then there's like pure being, or just being alive, or appreciating impermanent reality, is somehow separate. It's like an object that I have to balance with the other objects of my life. You know, I have to exercise and eat and take care of my family and be present to the inconceivable reality of my life. How am I going to get all these things in? So I've come to think that as balance is key, and mindfulness bell is a beautiful practice, but what about integration? What about not thinking so much about balance and reinforcing the sense of the Dharma of our meditation practice as an object out there apart from our moment-to-moment life? What about really thinking about integration? And not so much that there's a special state of mind that is what Zen practice is about, that we can only get in a certain room. And it's not a kind of balance as an oscillation, you know, that's back and forth between my busy life and my still life. But what about integration? What about not seeing what our meditation practice or our appreciation practice, our presence practice, not seeing that as an object that is kind of at the same level as other objects? C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, which I've heard described as required reading for Zen students. It's a wonderful book, Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. Anyway, he has a riff about how we end up talking about my God in the same way we talk about my boots. You know, it's kind of bringing the most important thing, the biggest thing, the thing that is our life itself, bringing that into our kind of conscious object-making mind and putting it at the same status, like on our shelf, along with everything else, you know, my practice, my boots, my job. But there's another way to see practice. That's to see meditation as suchness, as the reality of our life, as the fact of our life, as our ongoing opportunity to meet our life exactly where it is, not as some object that's external to our life. It's like I'm the mastermind, and then here's the little objects that I'm getting aligned, you know. If the Dharma is bigger than us, you know, if we're in the Dharma, we're not. How do you balance that, you know? How do you balance the womb that you abide in, you know, with boots and work and exercise? There's also a Zen saying, nothing is better than a good thing. Wonderful Zen saying. You have a good thing? Good. Come to Zazen. Take those 40 minutes. That's a good thing. But nothing is better. No gap. No gap is better. So we have these objects, and we have the Zendo, and we come to it, and we have a 40-minute period, but just again and again, encouraging myself to not make that be the point. That's not the extent. To not limit the Dharma in this way. So I'm curious how we find in our life these moments of churning. Say, I'm in Zazen all the time. Right now, I just got to the Zendo. It looks like I'm at work, but the Zendo just fell on me. how do we generate that mind? How do we turn? And do we really feel like at any moment we have a full opportunity? Like, oh, I should get to the Zendo today. I'm really stressed out. Can we really train ourselves that's a moment right there? That we can practice. That there's no gap between ourselves and the practice. There's no, we don't have to get over to the Zendo to do the practice. So how do we remind ourselves to turn? And then also, how do we do it in a way that doesn't mean that's going along with our life and opening to our life as it's unfolding rather than separating from our life, to appreciate our life, which is the basic, is okay to a point, you know, but is basically wrong-headed. So we just have a few minutes left. I have more to say, and I feel I've already said too much, but I'm curious if people's thoughts.
Thank you, Jerry. I like this idea of balance, but not in the sense of, kind of balance where two ends are not moving. But I experience myself as a kind of resonator. And I can find myself becoming entranced by form. I can also find myself becoming lost in noise. And having come from Green Gulch in January, I recall a very big point was made that the bodhisattva has to know many things as opposed to the arahat, who just is concerned about personal liberation. Bodhisattva has to know many things in order to be useful to others. And that keyed with me, and I'm wondering if what you think about this too. When I'm out there being helpful, over a period of time, noise invades my head and my being. And so I have to come to a place to get still. And then emptiness invades myself, and I have to go to a place to take the stillness. So there's a constant sense of movement for me between taking my stillness out there and bringing noise in here. And negotiating constantly where I can be helpful and harmless in that way. Does that resonate with your sense of balance or balance finding?
Yeah, I appreciate that. There's I appreciate that. I mean, we also talk about stillness within activity and movement within stillness, you know, which I think is a little more this feeling of kind of no gap, you know. So at one level there is a back and forth, and we do come and we do quiet down. But to never feel like our stillness is disconnected, you know, and then to never feel like our activity actually alienates us from stillness. If we, I guess, to come to the, to have the, to indulge the thought, I'm busy, I should go to the Zendo to calm down, that's okay. But to really, to not feel alienated, to not feel that we actually need to do that in order to be still. And it helps. I'm not saying it doesn't help or that we should stop doing it. But But I just found that that was blocking me, to think that I have to do that in order to be still, when actually the stillness is right here if I can turn. So maybe a mindfulness bell can turn it for me. Maybe I can do some practice of opening my awareness or mindfulness of the breath or the body. And then the stillness is right there, totally available in this sudden school. It doesn't take time. And there is no time, actually, so that's good that it doesn't take it. There's just now. And so it's kind of like we do this training or this kind of game with our mind to like get ourselves ready to give it what it thinks it needs in order to be still. But also it's available without going through that. Yeah, but I also really appreciate if we get too wide about this, like, hey, meditation practice is just everything in my life, you know? Like the Dharma practice equals my life in some very big way. Then it's so big that it's just, it loses its meaning, you know? There does have to be, it has to dig in somewhere, you know? If it's just everything, everything's practice, man. Don't worry. It's a little too open, you know? But it's true. So it's a question of feeling it, you know, finding it. I don't think these truths are in opposition, but I think they can be. And I was finding that they were for me. Thank you.
I can see how someone can object to the mindfulness bell, because it really does separate real life from real presence. However, being at work and being totally caught up in discursive thinking and my current book project, trying to write something, and so on, I've started to use ringing telephones. And I've started to use things that would usually annoy me, like very noisy conversations over the partition. Instead of going, I wish they were quiet. I'm hearing this. I'm just really using it like the clacker at the end of tuning. Like, boom, I'm here.
Snap out of it.
Yeah. But I understand how someone can say, I really don't need the mindfulness stuff. I need it. It helps me a lot.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is helpful. It's maybe not so much a question as not needing it as, for me, not being confused by it. Not being confused by it. There is... it's wonderful to stop. It's wonderful to stop and do nothing but breathe and do nothing but be. But when that's impossible, it's also still possible to practice, you know? But thank you. Yeah, that's good to use. For me, yeah, it's other people annoying, or phone, or my own, as I mentioned, my own thought of, geez, I wish I could practice. Because that, you know, that I've kind of gotten that to be a mindfulness bell for myself. I should get to the Zendo. It's like, okay, come, here you are. How do we? There is a place for interruption, you know. Interrupt our day to remember who we really are. But we are who we really are all day, and it's a pity to miss that, you know.
So everything that kind of moves you, you know, starts sounding like a Dharma tone.
Maybe one last comment up here.
I wanted to just appreciate first that you brought just the topic that you bring to this room of people who are not in the monastery and who spend all day, you know, out in the world, caught up. Whether it's with our young children or with our jobs, it's so helpful. I found your work so helpful. And I think, you know, that many of us are in the situation that you are in, that we're not doing multiple 40 periods of Sazen. We're fortunate if we're doing one or two periods of Sazen. So it's really helpful to think about practice in this way. And my question is about, sometimes I look back on my day and I think, is it the times that I stopped and remember that this was practice, that it was practice? Mm-hmm. You know? What about all the other moments that I was changing a diaper or talking to a student or making a meal, and I wasn't saying I'm mindfully making this meal. Sometimes it's very obvious when we're caught up, and then we go, whoa, I was really caught, you know, I was really like caught up. But I think there are many, many moments when we're just you know, living our life, not separate from it. But nor are we having this metacognition that this is practice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Thank you. That's a long-standing question for me. Is being absorbed, the goal of Zen in a way is being absorbed in the activity. There's just the activity. Become one with what it is, with your life. What's the difference between that and just being lost in activity, you know, caught up in activity? And I think, you know, I do love the mindfulness tradition, and I think it's helped the world and helped our culture tremendously. But in a way, I think part of the confusion comes from that Zen is a little different tradition, you know, and talks about things a little different way. So it's not necessarily I am aware that I am cutting the carrot. It's more just like that may or may not be there. And I may be misunderstanding mindfulness, but I think often we understand it in a kind of dualistic way. Like I had to have some awareness that I was doing this, as opposed to just becoming, being with no trace, you know? I have this idea like, at the end of the day, you have no idea what you did today, because you were just completely, there was just, and anyway, who would have time to remember? Because now there's just now, you know? It's actually kind of what parenting is like, or farming. So I think to value that, to not assume that that's not practice, and maybe check for self-centeredness, you know, if you have some time, you could check for some self-centeredness or check for flexibility. So it's almost like we get the feedback when we're off rather than getting the feedback when we're on, you know, like, oh, there's some self-clinging. There was some lack of flexibility, which actually means I wasn't just absorbed in the moment and then allowing it to become the next moment. I was absorbed in the moment and like got kind of mad when it tried to become the next moment. So I think opening to absorption, you know, and valuing that, completely being ourself. Thank you. Thank you all again for the invitation, and thanks for coming diligently sitting and sitting for a talk. These things, these practices that we do inconceivably support our ongoing moment by moment now practice of meditation and wisdom. And may it benefit ourselves and extend to all beings. Amen.